Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. When Confederate General John C. Pemberton surrendered the fortress of Vicksburg, which was the key to controlling the Mississippi River during the Civil War, Southern newspapers called him a traitor, a failure, and a bungling fool. This is mostly the narrative that historians have about Vicksburg, one of the most pivotal turning points in the Civil War. But are these accusations justified? Today, I'm talking with Dr. Samuel Mitchum, author of the new book, Vicksburg, The Bloody Siege That Turned the Tide of the Civil War. He argues that newspapers, and much of history itself, have wrongly marred Pemberton's legacy. He describes a dramatic account of the Confederate Army's exhaustive efforts under Pemberton to defend the fortress of Vicksburg from the spring of 1862 until its surrender on July 4, 1863. And the siege that went on for 2 months led to extensive tunneling in the town, where civilians would hide in the tunnels during naval bombardment, kind of like the Blitz of London in World War II. The residents of Vicksburg were forced to dig caves and eat rats to survive. But Mitchum argues that due to Pemberton's stalwart character and resourceful mind, they continued to trust his command despite dire circumstances. So if you're a military or Civil War enthusiast, I think there's a lot in this discussion will help you understand more deeply the conflict of the Civil War, why Vicksburg was such a crucial turning point, and how even though the Civil War ended over 150 years ago, in many ways the battle is still being fought today. Enjoy this discussion, Dr. Samuel Mitchum. Dr. Mitchum, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right. Well, you are a repeat guest. We had you on a year ago to talk about the cavalry tactics and also the life before and after the War of Nathan Bedford Forrest. Now in your new book, you are taking another look at Vicksburg. It's well known amongst Civil War historians and Civil War buffs. So just to set the stage, could you tell me how you think your book is different from other books about Vicksburg? And also, what importance do historians typically attribute to Vicksburg in the Civil War?
A lot of historians neglected in favor of Gettysburg, which happened at the same time. Some of them will say that Gettysburg was the turning point of the war. I think the war was big enough to have two turning points, and the South really lost more at Vicksburg than it did at Gettysburg. At Gettysburg, Lee's second invasion of the North came to an end. He had to retreat back to Virginia. He lost about 23,000 men at Gettysburg. The South lost an entire army at Vicksburg, 30,000 men, and another 5,000 in the battles leading up to the siege. So that's 35,000 men. They also lost control of the Mississippi River, which means they effectively Richmond lost control of Louisiana and Arkansas, Texas, Oklahoma, and parts of Mississippi. It also made the Union blockade very effective. Prior to Vicksburg, you could get your war materials, if you were an exporter, to the South. You could put your munitions on boats with British flags on them, and they would sail right past the Union blockade. The Yankees couldn't do anything about it unless they wanted to start a war with the United Kingdom, which they did not want to do. Anyway, land your ships in Mexico, ship them by wagon across Texas, Louisiana, and all the way to Virginia if you needed to. So economically speaking, Vicksburg was a crippling blow, and militarily speaking as well. Oh, another way it differs is I take a little bit different view of the Confederate commander, John C. Pemberton. Pemberton was denounced throughout the Southern newspapers, throughout the press, as a traitor. He was from Philadelphia, and he did surrender on the 4th of July, and they erroneously assumed that, you know, it was because he was a traitor. He was not. He was loyal to the South, and he was a lot better general than is commonly portrayed. My book is mainly from the Confederate point of view. And, of course, Grant is held up as a genius. And his last campaign was genius, giving this due, but it was his eighth attempt to take Vicksburg. It was the sixth attempt to take it by military means. And, Pemberton is portrayed as a blithering idiot. And I just ask the reader this, if you outnumber me 2-1 and you have a Navy and I don't, and I still beat you 5 out of 6 times in campaigns involving military action, and I'm a blithering idiot, what does that make you?
Well, yeah, I'd like to get your take on Vicksburg. A point that you make early on in the book is that this battle is almost always told from the perspective of the Union, and you're trying to look at it from the Confederate perspective. Why is it typically told from the perspective of the Union? Is that because of Vicksburg's symbolic importance for strengthening the Union blockade or some other reason?
Well, I think it goes back to what Voltaire says. History is the propaganda of the victor. And the victor writes the history, and the North has written the history, New England, New York. That's the core of it. Nobody really stopped to take a look at the Southern side. And maybe that's human nature. But I did. I went to the Old City Courthouse Museum in Vicksburg, and they have a huge amount of diaries and letters and original sources that hardly anybody's ever touched. One diary in particular was fascinating to me by a brilliant writer. Her name was Elizabeth Mead Ingram, and when I started reading it, I thought, typical Mississippi plantation owner's wife. Her husband was off in the war when the Yankees came and sacked her home. And she castigated them pretty good, even to their faces. But turns out that she was the sister of George Gordon Meade, the Union commander at Gettysburg. This came as quite a surprise, and yet she was running a plantation there near Port Gibson, Mississippi, and wrote a brilliant diary, which unfortunately she ended when she received word that her last son had been killed in action in the Battle of Chancellorsville, fighting for Robert E. Lee and against her own uncle. Or guess his own uncle. Anyway, things like that make it different. Things that haven't been used. I go into what they actually suffered in Vicksburg. Most of the time it's dismissed the Confederates were starved out and had to surrender, but that meant quite a lot. This little city, it was pounded, and there wasn't a single pane of unbroken glass in the whole city by the time it was over. And there were no dogs left, there were no cats left, horses, mules. They even had some alligators there that they ate. General Pemberton was particularly fond of alligator tongue. And rats. Nobody in Vicksburg would eat a rat before the siege. By the end of the siege, they had a shortage of rats. A rat would sell for $3.50 in the public meat market by July 3rd, 1863. The average Southern private got paid $11 a month.
Wow.
So we're talking over 2 weeks' pay. Now, imagine yourself hungry enough to spend your two-week paycheck for a rat. That's how hungry they were. And Vicksburg also stank. They had enough water for drinking, but they didn't have enough water for bathing. Lice was rampant. Boys in gray joked that they saw lice sometimes that were so big they had CSA, Confederate States of America, branded on them. Yet the morale held up, and I thought that was pretty remarkable because that a lot of people would be ready to give up by that time. But when Pemberton finally surrendered, a lot of them cried. Grown men. They'd been sitting in the trenches for 47 days, not able to get up and exercise or move. Their joints were stiff, covered in lice and pretty smelly. Hadn't been able to bathe in 47 days. It was it must have been pretty ripe by then. And of course, added to the problem, and this was a problem on both sides, was 1863 was one of the worst years on record for mosquitoes in Mississippi. And they didn't have modern mosquito repellents. Matter of fact, both sides joked about it. They said mosquitoes was the only crop that never failed in Mississippi.
Must have been just terrible levels of malaria for both sides at that time.
Yes, there was malaria, and measles was a big killer. We think of it today as a childhood disease. In the 19th century, it was very much an adult disease, too. And there was no cure for it, and you had to outlast it. They could make you comfortable, but a lot of men died from measles. And you know, typhus and a lot of diseases there. And the surgeons in the Civil War, frankly, were worth a hoot. Over half of all Civil War surgeons had never practiced medicine before the war. And quite a few of them just weren't any good at it. And that contributed to the death rate. And something I found visiting the Medical Museum of the Confederacy, and this mitigated in favor of the South and very much against the North. The way they took care of wounded people, Southern doctors had sterilized rags. And if you were wounded, they would use a rag on you to stop the bleeding or bandage you or whatever. When they were through with it, they would throw it in this big barrel. And they'd fill up several barrels in the major battles. And then later, they would wash them and boil them and sterilize them, and then use them again in the next battle, but not again in the same battle. The North didn't do that. They used sponges. And, you know, you can't completely get everything out of a sponge. So if they've treated me and, they treat you with the same sponge, you're liable to get a little blood poisoning there. You know, if you're O positive, but I may be negative, you could have a serious problem, and you're already wounded and weakened. It could end up being fatal. And you know, that I thought was an interesting way. I found a rather interesting story by a surgeon. For some reason, they decided to open fire on his hospital, even though it flew a yellow flag, which indicated a hospital. And the Union gunboats blew it away, and he was trapped and severely wounded. And, he was forced to operate on himself and had to amputate his own leg, but he survived, which I thought was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that's quite a pain tolerance.
Yes. I guess you can do whatever you need to do to stay alive, but I'm not sure I could handle that kind of pain. He did. But 1 out of 6 Confederate soldiers was in the hospital at the end of the siege. It's that bad.
To get a maybe look at this from a flyover view, could you explain to me what a siege means in the middle of the 19th century? I have a bit of a gap in my mind from a military perspective, because I have a sense of the siege of Stalingrad in World War II, where you might have a tank corps, or in World War II, sieges have a different meaning because then you have issues of aerial supremacy. I have an understanding of sieges in the medieval context. You have forts, you have walled cities, you have archers up there, you have catapults. But what does a siege look like in the Civil War? And could you paint a picture also on the ground? You mentioned that there was a blockade on Vicksburg. People had to eat rats. What was holding the siege back from entering the city? Were there some sort of fortifications or walls or entrenchments? What did that all look like?
Well, I guess I should say, starting out, that the military engineers on both sides were better than the commanders on both sides, and by a pretty wide margin. General Pemberton was a great engineer. If you've ever seen the movie Glory, Glory, where that 54th Massachusetts, the all-black regiment was slaughtered, General Pemberton designed the fort. And they had several other excellent engineers. Martin Luther Smith was a general, but he later was the chief engineer of the Army of Northern Virginia and the Army of Tennessee. They had another minor officer who later rose to rank a colonel. He had graduated from West Point in 1859, so he was a young man, and wasn't even in his mid-20s yet, but he was an engineering genius. And they created a fort that when the Northerners approached it, the veterans turned pale, because it one of them compared it to the serrated walls of a medieval castle. And Grant was in a position, he didn't know that the commander of the Western Front for the Confederates was a man named Joe Johnston, and he let the South and Pemberton down. He did not make a serious attempt to relieve Vicksburg after it was besieged. But Grant didn't know he was going to fail to do that, so he launched two hasty attacks. Now, 2 days before the first attack on Vicksburg, he had routed the Confederate Army. First time significant part of a Southern army had run away in a big Black River. So he, I think, quite reasonably decided that Pemberton wouldn't be able to rally his army in 48 hours, and that the first attempt would break the entrenched line, and he would be able to capture Vicksburg. Well, logically, he was right, but in reality, he was wrong. Pemberton did succeed in rallying his army. He put out a rather stirring proclamation, and they were ready for the attack, and Grant was badly repulsed. So 3 days later, he had tried a prepared attack as opposed to a hasty attack, and Sherman compared it to wheat being cut by a scythe. Men were just slaughtered. One Confederate observed the field was blue with dead. They lost well over 3,000 men. The South lost about 500. Grant and the two assaults combined lost over 10% of his army. And this convinced Grant that he wasn't going to take it by main assault, at least not right away. So he compared it to a snowball. He said, "Vicksburg is a snowball. We will let it melt." And that's what he did. He launched some more probes, some more pretty serious attacks, but no major attack like the first two on May 19th and 22nd. And he was preparing another one for July the 6th. But Pemberton surrendered on July 4th because he felt he could get better terms on that day than any other day. And I think history's proven him right. He met with General Grant, and Pemberton was in a very foul mood that day anyway. He felt it was the end of his military career, which it was. And Grant demanded unconditional surrender. And Pemberton, you know what they say about negotiations, never be afraid to walk away. And he got up to leave, and he looked Grant right in the eye and said, with that demand, you will bury many more of your men before you ever enter Vicksburg. Hmm. And Grant sort of did a double take and turned to some of his officers and said, well, let's set up a negotiation commission, which is what Pemberton's lieutenant had suggested earlier, and work out the terms. In other words, he backed off of unconditional surrender. And this was Pemberton's last great service to his army, because under unconditional surrender, they would have ended up in a northern prison. And they were already so weakened by starvation and disease that thousands of them would have died there. But under the terms, none of the Confederates had to go to prison. They could accept a parole and everybody could go home. And that worked out pretty well for General Grant, because he figured after what they'd been through, a lot of those men wouldn't come back. And most of them didn't. We don't have any exact figures, but I think 25, maybe 30% returned to the Army. The rest of them went home and stayed home. They had had their war. And a lot of them were from Louisiana and Texas. And after they went home, even if they returned to the Army, they were on the wrong side of the river. The war would be decided in the East. Men west of the Mississippi were about as much use to the Confederacy as if they had been in China. It worked out pretty well for Grant. Now, some of them did fight again. In fact, I wrote a book. My first Civil War book was on the Red River Campaign, and a lot of these men were paroled, but the Yankees went through the Red River Valley burning houses. And some of the houses were belonged to these parolees. And they broke their parole. They joined the Confederate Army. Their reasoning, you know, legally speaking, it was punishable by death. But what they felt was, if it's legal for you to burn my house, it's legal for me to shoot you. And they played a major role in the Battle of Mansfield, which was one of the most embarrassing Union defeats in the war. General Richard Taylor, with 8,800 men, defeated a Union army of 32,000 and chased it 200 miles all the way across Louisiana.
Well, a lot of what you focus on with Vicksburg is General Pemberton. And you mentioned at the beginning of our talk that he has been looked upon poorly by history, and even Southern newspapers called him incompetent or a traitor. So could you describe to me, why is there a negative perception of Pemberton and his leadership? And why do you argue the opposite?
In a nutshell, he lost. Albert Sidney Johnston, another Confederate general, said the measure of popularity in my profession is success. And in the end, he failed, and he was forced to surrender. I look into it a little more depth. I want to know why he failed. And the reason, to me, boils down to his commanding officer, Joseph Johnston. The first thing Johnston did was take away Pemberton's cavalry. Most people don't realize it, but Pemberton was more blind in the Vicksburg campaign, the last one, than Robert E. Lee was at Gettysburg. He had fewer cavalry. He only had a few Mississippi Home Guard cavalry, you know, people who did their washing at home, and they weren't in any way equal to a regular Confederate cavalry force. And he was blind, and he had defeated Grant before up in northern Mississippi by sending cavalry around his flank into his rear and destroying his supply depots. And he couldn't do that this time. He didn't have the horsemen. And Johnston didn't like to fight battles. They have a story about him. Mary Chestnut told about it in her diary. He and some of the officers went hunting for pheasants. And Johnston was a good shot, but he wouldn't take a shot unless he was sure of a kill. So at the end of the day, he had not fired a shot. And he was the only officer there who had not missed all day long. But he hadn't killed any birds either. He was the only officer without a dead pheasant in his pouch. He approached battle that way. A year later, in the Battle of Atlanta, he just kept retreating. And there was a joke around the Confederacy at that time, General Johnston will fight the Battle of Atlanta from Key West, Florida. And that's why Jefferson Davis fired him in front of Atlanta. Davis wanted him to guarantee he would fight and not abandon Atlanta without a fight. And Johnston half the time wouldn't even answer his messages. He wouldn't guarantee anything. And I think Jefferson Davis was right to fire him. His choice of a replacement was unfortunate. It was John Bell Hood, and he wasn't in any way qualified to command an army. But the South had men that were, and if Davis had made the correct appointment, it's possible that Atlanta would have held until after the presidential election, and Abraham Lincoln was behind in the polls. All the experts thought Lincoln would lose the election, including Abraham Lincoln. But after Atlanta fell, northern public opinion turned. They saw the end of the war was in sight, the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will. And they decided to reelect Lincoln and win the war. And of course, they did.
Right. Yeah. Johnson, he kind of sounds like a Confederate version of McClellan, the Union general that went probably slower than a glacier with his army and was so over deliberate that couldn't get anything done.
Yeah, he was very much.
So
a good comparison, by the way.
Yeah, he's an interesting figure too. And I can imagine for Pemberton how heartbreaking it would be, especially for a Civil War general to not have your cavalry, since they just loved flanking maneuvers and that type of tactic. Could you also describe some other factors? How would you describe his strategy during Vicksburg? What was Pemberton's plan to win? And as you mentioned, he has severe manpower shortage, as most Confederate soldiers do. But what strategy did he have in order to successfully break the siege?
Well, Pemberton, there were 10 different Union attempts to take the place. The last one was successful. Of those 10, 8 of them involved Pemberton, and he treated every one of them differently depending on the circumstances. One that he allowed the Union decided to go through the bayous and the rivers and even creeks to get behind the Confederate flank. And he would cut trees in front of them. He had one time he had like 2 miles worth of trees downed, and the Yankees had to remove every one. Another time, he let the fleet go right on through and cut the trees down behind it. And by the time they realized they had been trapped, and they were in a mess. And they barely got the fleet out. So he varied it. The last time, he was in a conundrum. General Johnston wanted him to have what today we would call a meeting engagement against Grant. Jefferson Davis ordered him to hold Vicksburg at all hazards. And the orders were somewhat mutually exclusive, but he tried to execute both. And he later said if he had to do one thing differently, he would not obey General Johnston's orders. Pemberton had a good defensive position along Big Black River, which has very steep banks. And he wanted to force Grant to attack across the river, and he would have had to get to Vicksburg. Johnston told him to abandon that position and move east. And the result was a battle at Champion Hill. And Pemberton was outnumbered 2-1 and defeated. And by the time he retreated to Big Black River, he just simply didn't have the army he had a week before, following the defeat at Champion Hill. One of his divisions was cut off and actually escaped to the east, but Pemberton didn't even know what happened to it. So that kind of made the siege inevitable. Pemberton made some mistakes, but he didn't make nearly as many as many people assume. He was a good general. He wasn't a great general. Nobody's ever going to confuse him with Napoleon or even Robert E. Lee, but I think he was every bit the General Grant and Sherman were.
Yeah, that's what I think is one of the most fascinating aspects of the Civil War compared to other major wars in American history, that before the Civil War, the U.S. military is very small, and even generals could have sometimes almost no combat experience. So you simply don't know how good someone is going to be until they actually engage in combat, even if they are a general. So I'm always surprised by that fact.
Well, a lot of them did have some combat experience. Pemberton had quite a bit. He fought in the Seminole War against the Indians, and then he fought in the Mexican War.
Right.
Took command of a company, in fact, after the commander was killed, and led it with a great deal of force and determination. I'm impressed. General Worth, one of the major generals in that campaign, who made him his aide and adjutant for the rest of the war. But, he saved a man's life and actually had his straw hat shot off his head by one of the Mexicans. So he had some Grant, had good Mexican War experience. They didn't have medals in those days. They gave brevets, honorary promotion, for which you did not get paid, but you could claim the rank. Grant got two brevets, and Pemberton got two, and Stonewall Jackson got two. Robert E. Lee got three. Rank was captain, but he was called colonel from then on out. Got a brevet colonel.
Well, I'd like to ask about the overall significance of Vicksburg. And one thing that Lincoln, a phrase Lincoln used to describe it, is that the war could never be brought to a close until that key is in our pocket. So what was the significance of the Confederacy losing control of Vicksburg? You said it was one of two key turning points, not simply Gettysburg. And What is the significance, do you think, that others have overlooked?
The way around the blockade was stopped. Four southern states were lost. Also, the economics for the North was tremendous. There was a lot of pressure on Lincoln to take Vicksburg and free the river. political pressure. All right, 1861, the war starts. Up until then, the Confederacy said that they would not charge anything for anybody from the Midwest. They called it the Northwest in those days, to ship their goods and services by boat down the Mississippi River. But the Confederacy was still a foreign country, and it made the Midwesterners nervous because even today, river transportation is the cheapest form of transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the war began, they cut it off. You couldn't get your wheat crop or your corn to New Orleans to ship it to Europe, and therefore you had to ship it by rail. And the term robber baron hadn't been invented yet, but that's what the owners of the Northern Railroads were. When they found out that the river was cut off, they jacked up the freight rates out of sight and tremendously increased the cost of producing a crop for a Midwestern farmer, many of whom went bankrupt. A lot of them were financially devastated by this. And by 1863, you had a regional depression in the Midwest. And that's one reason the Union General McClellan there, McClelland, had such success in recruiting. They felt they had to break the Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi, or their family farms were going to go under. And they were quite right. That increased transportation costs made it unprofitable to produce goods, grains, in the Midwest. Anyway, I look at that a little bit, too. Vicksburg was important for a number of reasons. And it was, though, Sherman called it the perfect military position, and even Lincoln recognized how important it was. He had gone down the Mississippi River as a young man in a flatboat, and the river at that time did a 180-degree turn back on itself, right underneath the 200-foot bluffs of Vicksburg. And it was the perfect, as Sherman said, the perfect military position. Even Lincoln recognized that. Lincoln was not did not have a great military background. He was made a captain in the Black Hawk War, but he did such a poor job they busted into private, and he never heard a shot fired. And you know, contrast that with Jefferson Davis, who was second lieutenant, just graduated from West Point, went up one combat mission in the Black Hawk War and personally captured Chief Black Hawk and ended the war. So Davis had some things going for him. Lincoln didn't in terms of being commander-in-chief. But he makes both of them made serious mistakes, but Lincoln had a population base of 23 million. Davis had a white population base of a little less than 6 million. When you outnumber your opponent that badly, you can make mistakes and get away with it in the long run. And they did. Both sides made some serious errors.
And by bringing to light, when you research the Confederate side in Vicksburg, and along with the soldiers, also civilians as well. Do you think that the civilian experience of the siege has been overlooked too, and as historians have looked at Vicksburg?
I largely did. You know, military historians tend to look at military people, but the women of Vicksburg were tough. When the Confederate Army retreated into Vicksburg, they chewed them out. What are you doing here? You're supposed to be defending to the east. You're not supposed to be here. And they'd lost the Battle of Big Black River. And they said, told, it's General Pemberton's fault. The women said, no, it's not. It's your fault. You didn't fight hard enough. they didn't catch much slack. And later, as the siege went on, a small group wrote a petition calling on General Pemberton to surrender. But he never saw the petition because nobody except the three or four people who drafted the petition would sign it. When General Bowen, the Confederate division commander, probably the best of the Southern generals in the pocket, he took part in the surrender negotiations. He and Grant were good friends before the war. In fact, at one of the low point of Grant's life, he had to cut firewood and deliver it in Carondelet, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis. And General Bowen was a very prosperous architect at an architectural firm. And he bought all his firewood from General Grant and saw to it that his company did as well. So they knew each other well. And anyway, Bowen was instrumental in the surrender negotiations. And a lady who had mended his uniform said a few days before, said, well, if I'd known he was going to do that, I wouldn't have mended his uniform. she was, they were pretty tough. Those caves were pretty terrible. The soil there is what's called less soil, and you can build mine shafts if you want to without supporting beams, because it holds its consistency that well. But sometimes they were hit by 13-inch mortar shells from the Union fleet. That's 250 pounds of high explosive. The engineering genius, Major Lockett, measured a hole where one hit in the ground, and it was 11 feet deep. That's how much impact they had. They would collapse a cave, and sometimes they did. I found a diary by a man who was in a cave when I'm hit, and part of the cave collapsed, and he saw this 10-year-old girl buried alive. His name was Reverend Marshall. Anyway, they fortunately he saw her go away, and her mother managed to dig her out. She was revived, not seriously hurt, but one woman got up and realized she had been in bed all night with a 6-foot snake. They flooded, and they smelled. One interesting little sideline, some of these caves had up to 200 people. And you would, there were different reactions in different parts of the country. In Vicksburg, which was a very cosmopolitan town before the war, blacks and whites would sleep side by side in these caves, and there was no racial animus. There was no distinction. They treated each other as equals during the siege. They may not have done so afterwards, but during the siege they did. Anyway, that's kind of look at the civilian side. They had rat holes. They'd get out of the caves when the Union wasn't firing, and sometimes the Yankees would open fire with their artillery or the naval guns unexpectedly, and they couldn't get back to the cave. But they had dug little holes in the ground, kind of like foxholes. They called them rat holes. And when the Yankees opened up, they would scream every rat to his hole. Everybody would jump in a rat hole. And there were relatively few civilians killed. Only about 40-odd people were killed during the siege, despite the fact it went on 47 days and pretty continuous.
Why were so few civilians killed? Why would that be the case that so few civilians were killed?
They prepared. They had caves. This was really the second siege of Vicksburg. The year before, 1862, they had one that lasted 67 days. It wasn't as spectacular because the Yankees did not attempt any land assaults. They didn't feel they had the men, and they were quite correct. They would not have taken it by a land assault. But they bombarded the city and killed a few people with their naval gunfire. And the Vicksburgians already had a head start on building caves and rat holes. And they were pretty slick about it. They understood things. They understood that if a Yankee shell passed over your head, you were probably safe because the explosion was going to go mostly forward. They save their outside activities for lunch because Union gunners like to eat lunch. And they'd take lunch off so the ladies would go into the town and buy whatever provisions they could, if they could find any, and get back to their caves or their little foxholes before the Yankees finished dessert and opened up on them again. Also, during the heat of the day, the Yankees would take a break. Most of the days during this siege, it was kind of unseasonably hot. Most of the days were 100 degrees. And, people from Wisconsin aren't so good at taking 100-degree heat as people from, say, southern Alabama. They would often call a two-hour halt, go under a shade tree and drink water, Illuminate or whatever. And the people of Vicksburg would take advantage of that. They kind of knew what they were doing.
Yeah, it sounds like the Blitz in London almost during World War II, with civilians having a routine of what to do when the bombing raids begin.
Yeah. Also, it's a rather strange phenomenon, but the caves closer to the Confederate lines were safer than the ones farther away, because the Union gunboats didn't want to take the chance of overshooting and killing their own men. And that was especially true later in the siege because a mortar or a cannon is like, a tire on a car. It doesn't last forever. And yourself, you buy a brand new set of tires, they're perfectly fine, but you put 50 or 60,000 miles on them, they're no longer as reliable as they were. And neither were these big guns. They were worn out by the end of the siege. They'd fired so many rounds into Vicksburg. One officer, Lowenbrow, his wife's cave partially collapsed. He moved his family right up to the back of the siege line, just behind the Confederate reserve positions. And they were perfectly safe. Or at least reasonably safe. I mean, it could only be, no place in Vicksburg was completely safe.
Right.
About one man who was sitting in his rocking chair in his house, and a mini ball passed through his beard. but he was stubborn. He refused to leave his home. But his wife and children immediately did. There were people offering to build up caves for $50 to $300, which is a lot of money. And they had more business than they can handle. The Yankees, in fact, by the end of the siege, were calling Vicksburg a prairie dog town. So many caves and foxholes and such.
Well, yeah, thanks for this overview, Vicksburg, and I'm sure there's a lot more to get into. So I guess to tie in the significance of this battle, you've written much on the Civil War. You've also written quite a bit on World War II. And we mentioned this in our last discussion that World War II always seemed to get the lion's share of public interest among people who have a casual interest in history. But more and more, it seems people are interested in the Civil War. So what do you think it means now in the 21st century to have a better understanding of the Civil War as you try to bring some of these stories to light and try to, from your point, balance a perspective a bit? What importance do you think this has today?
Oh, sometimes I think we're still fighting it. I think that's why some people would like to remove the monuments. I disagree. I teach history. I don't try to erase it. I don't desecrate graves. I think a lot of our heritage comes from these people, and we should be proud of it, both sides, really. They were doing what they thought was right by the light that they had to see what was right. Many people today look at history from the present to the past, and they try to impose present-day cultural mores on the people of the past. And to me, that's just wrong, because they don't live their lives that way. We don't live our lives from the present to the past. We live our lives from our present to our future.
Mm-hmm.
The people of the past live their lives from their present to their future. And you got to judge them by their own times, not by our present, like I said, cultural mores. I mean,
yeah, a lot of issues. And as you said, the Civil War, it's still contentious many years later. Well, you have a lot. You have a lot to say in your book on Vicksburg, and I think for enthusiasts of military history, or just history in general, as you related these stories, we'll find things interesting there. It's called The Bloody Vicksburg, The Bloody Siege That Turned the Tide of the Civil War. Dr. Mitchum, thank you for joining us.
Hey, I enjoyed it, Scott. Appreciate it.
All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our two spy masters, Carl from Norway, and Baron Freza de Raveo at Napoli. And I'll explain what the Knowlton's Rangers are in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War. But it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with complete access to the History Unplugged archives. Right now, there are only the most recent 20 episodes on our podcast feed, but you can get all 270 episodes I've ever produced, and they make up hundreds of hours of content. If you join at the level of intelligence officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the eunuch, the harem servant girl, and the soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the scouts and intelligence officers, you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history-related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.